sleeping. Sometimes Julie looks a little zoned out. She has a tough life, but I never saw her sleeping.
How about Kruger?
I never saw Kruger sleeping.
He looked at Briggs.
Sometimes she disappears for a while.
Where does she go? I asked Ziegler.
Ziegler grinned. Sometimes she gets the orderlies to diddle her in the day room. I figure it's none of my business, but since you asked.
Do you have any idea how these patients disappeared while you were working security?
Morelli asked Ziegler.
No, sir, Ziegler said. I think it must have been aliens. You know how they can beam you up?
That's on television, Morelli said.
Maybe, Ziegler said.
I followed Morelli out of the hospital, and we buckled ourselves into the SUV.
Aliens, Morelli said. I think he was serious.
It is hard to explain. And hell, I was carrying a chunk of wood around with me that I almost believed was putting ideas into my head. I was ready to believe just about anything. We called ahead to Pino's and ordered meatball subs. Morelli stopped at his house and got Bob and a six-pack of Bud. We picked the subs up and took everything to my apartment. We were in front of the television eating the subs, drinking beer, and watching a pre-game show for the Mets. I heard something go foomph from the parking lot, and my living room window shattered. Morelli vaulted over the couch, picked something off the floor, threw it out the shattered window, and a moment later there was a loud explosion from the parking lot. I went to the window and stood next to Morelli. Three cars were furiously burning. One was Morelli's. The Buick was fine.
I'm thinking about marrying a woman who gets rockets launched into her living room,
Morelli said.
What's wrong with this picture?
You're thinking about marrying me?
I've been thinking about marrying you for 10 years, Morelli said. Do you want to explain this latest terrorist attack to me?
It's all a misunderstanding. Some nutcase guy thinks I'm in a relationship with Ranger.
Are you?
In a relationship with Ranger? No, I'm working for him.
And this is why the nutcase guy just fired off a rocket into your living room?
Yes.
Do you know him by name?
Not exactly. Ranger's working on it. Emergency vehicles were pouring into my parking lot. Fire trucks, EMTs, police cars.
I suppose I should go downstairs and explain this to them,
Morelli said. What will you say?
I'll say I haven't a clue, and I'm absolutely not going to tell anyone I picked it up and chucked it out your window.
He turned when he got to the door.
I want you to call Ranger and tell him I'm not happy.
Bob and I watched the circus in the parking lot for a while, and I called Ranger. Morelli wants me to tell you he's not happy, I said to Ranger.
I already talked to Morelli.
Was he happy?
No.
Your guy shot a missile into my living room.
Yeah, he hit Amanda Olison's townhouse, too. He shot it into her front window.
Was anyone hurt?
No, but the townhouse was destroyed. Amanda and Kinsey were in the back of the house when the explosion occurred.
Where are they now?
I have them in a safe house.
Are they going through with the wedding? I asked.
They're trying to decide.
They should cancel. It's too dangerous.
Babe, you just want to get out of wearing the pink dress.
True. Bob and I were watching the game when Morelli finally came back to the apartment. I heard the door open and slam shut. Locks were flipped, and Morelli went into the kitchen. A minute later, he came to the couch with a beer in his hand. Well, I asked.
It was a direct hit on my car. There's nothing left of it.
I bit into my lower lip to keep from smiling. I didn't want to make matters worse by laughing at Morelli, but there was some humor to the fact that Morelli tossed the thing onto his own car. Of course, there was also the possibility that in my state of mild hysteria, the line between horrible and hilarious was blurred, and it wasn't all that funny that Morelli blew his car up. Sorry, I said. Morelli chugged down a bottle of beer.
It's you. You're a disaster magnet. I'm surprised this building hasn't been wiped out by a tornado. How could it possibly have escaped a tornado?
Maybe tomorrow?
I'm serious, Morelli said. You're like one of those people who keep getting hit by lightning.
Hey, it's no picnic for me either. Do you think I like having rockets shot into my living room? Do you think I like getting poisoned, threatened with cremation, and forced into a pink taffeta dress?
Don't forget the stun gun, Morelli said. You got stunned.
And this all happened in 1 week. I sucked in some air and burst into tears.
You're right.
I said, sobbing. And it's even worse. I got two more cars totally toasted and my arm slashed. I'm a walking time bomb.
Oh, geez, Morelli said, putting his beer bottle down and wrapping his arms around me. I didn't mean to make you cry. I hate when you cry. I got carried away with the disaster magnet thing.
I'm a big, humongous mess. I need an exorcist. He wiped away a tear that had streaked down my face.
You're not that much of a mess, Cupcake. And to tell you the truth, I don't think an exorcist would help a lot. It's not like you're a biblical mess. You just have a knack for rolling in dog dew.
I wiped my nose on the back of my hand. That's awful.
It's not so bad. Bob rolls in dog dew, and we love Bob, right?
Yes.
Well, there you have it.
Morelli kissed me on the top of my head.
You know what you need? A beer. I could use another one, too. Don't go away.
I watched Morelli trot off to the kitchen, and I was half worried he wasn't coming back. If I was in his shoes, I might be tempted to grab Bob and head for the hills. Of course, Morelli didn't have a car, so I guess that would slow him down. At any rate, he was right. I needed a beer. And he was right about the dog duty, too. Even when I was a kid, I had a knack for pushing the boundaries of common sense and normal behavior. I walked into the boys' bathroom in grade school because I was convinced I was invisible. I jumped off the roof of my parents' garage because I thought I could fly. And that was the tip of the iceberg. And I'm still pushing boundaries, flopping around in water that's over my head. And here's the scary part that I wouldn't say out loud to anyone. I'm a little addicted to it. I like my crazy job and my disaster-prone life. Not that I want a bomb in my living room, but I've come to like the adventure. I was hooked into the challenge of the manhunt, and the occasional rush of adrenaline was sort of invigorating. Chapter 20 Morelli and Bob left just as the sun was coming up. I gave Morelli the keys to the Buick and told him I'd try to stay out of trouble. I went back to bed and woke up to blinding daylight and Ranger standing at my bedside with coffee. He was wearing Rangeman black cargo pants and T-shirt, and he was, as always, armed. He wore custom-tailored suits when he was talking to clients, but at all other times he dressed like the rest of his men.
"What the heck?" I said.
"I have a full day, and I need to talk to you."
"Is that coffee for me?"
"Yes."
I sat up and took the coffee. "What's going on?"
"I left keys to an SUV on your kitchen counter. I have someone coming over to fix your window. I got a call from the bridal salon that they were worried about your shoes. They wondered if you had pink shoes, and they reminded you that you were wearing sneakers and not heels when you tried the dress."
I burst out laughing at the thought of Ranger taking the message.
"It's not funny," Ranger said. "One more message like that and I'll get my nuts repossessed."
"Anything else?"
"Yes. I've ruled out all but one man in my unit, and he's supposed to be dead. His name is Oren Carr, and he was a unit demo expert. He was reported killed in Afghanistan, but there are pieces of information in some of the notes that only Oren would know. Oren was a unit whack job. He would walk through minefields with his eyes closed because he thought he had divine protection."
"How did he feel about fire?"
"He loved fire. He said it was the great purifier."
I sipped my coffee. "Are you close to catching him?"
"No. I'm chasing down a dead man. He isn't leaving any markers."
"Can I help?"
"Yes. Get the shoe thing straightened out so I don't have to talk to that woman again."
And he left. I rolled out of bed, carried my coffee into the bathroom, and took a shower. A half hour later, I was dressed in a black T-shirt and a short denim skirt that I hadn't worn since high school, and my phone rang. It was Lula.
"Where the heck are you?" she asked. "We got Grandma here, and she's got big news. She's been snooping."
"What's the news?"
"You gotta hear it from Grandma. I thought for sure you'd be here by now."
Grandma got on the phone.
"I went undercover to Cranberry Manor with Florence Michalowski last night," Grandma said. "She was going to visit her friend Marlin, and I told her I wanted to go along to see the place. So we were sitting there having a cup of tea, and who do you think comes in?"
"Susan Cubbin.
Flo's friend knew her right off, and Mrs. Cubbin goes straight to the office her husband used to have and starts pulling open all the drawers and looking under the desk and in all the books in his bookshelf. And the whole time that young girl who took us around, what's her name, is trying to stop Mrs. Cubbin, and Mrs. Cubbin's having none of it. I tell you, she was on a mission, and we're standing there watching it all. And then Mrs. Cubbin is rummaging around in a file drawer, and she goes, aha, and she runs out of the office and out of the building. She found something, I said. Yeah, she had a big folded-up paper in her hand, like a poster or something. Lula got back on the phone.
We gotta go see Susan Cubbin. I bet she knows where the money is, and it might be with her jerk husband.
I'm on my way. Give me 15 minutes. I left Tiki with Rex, and I ran to the car with my messenger bag in one hand and a gun in the other.
Look at you in a skirt today,
Lula said when I walked in. I took a cruller out of the box on Connie's desk. I need to do laundry. This was the only thing left in my closet. Lula looked out the window.
You have another new car.
It's Ranger's. Morelli had to borrow the Buick.
What's wrong with Morelli's SUV?
It sort of got blown up. Everyone looked at me with their eyebrows raised. It's a long story, I said. Not worth telling. Grandma Lula and I trooped out of the office and got into the shiny, immaculate black Jeep Liberty.
I'd like to know where he gets all these new cars, Lula said. It's like they drop out of the sky. And the other question is, how does he get insurance when you keep blowing them up?
I don't blow them all up, I said. I drove to the Cubbin house in Hamilton Township and parked in the driveway behind the van. We went to the door, and Susan opened it before I had a chance to ring the bell.
I saw you drive up, she said. Now what?
Just checking in, I said.
I recognize the old lady, Susan said. She was at Cranberry Manor last night. You want to know what I was doing, right?
I'm not so old, Grandma said. I got a bunch of good years left in me. What were you doing there? I asked Susan.
I was looking for the money. What else would I be doing?
Did you find it?
When I find it, all you'll see is an empty house.
What about the big albino? Has he been around?
The realtor?
I don't think he's a realtor.
Whatever. Haven't seen him.
Grandma craned her neck to look around Susan into the living room.
This is a real nice house. I like your decorating.
I did it myself. I was going for the Americana look.
You got it, Grandma said. What's with the suitcase in your living room? Are you planning a vacation?
No, I'm cleaning out my closet.
We left Susan and returned to the Jeep.
I think she was fibbing about cleaning out her closet, Grandma said.
Suppose you embezzled $5 million, I asked Grandma and Lula. Where would you put it?
I guess it would be in a bank account somewhere, Lula said. It's not like he robbed a liquor store. He probably took some here and there. That's a lot of money to take out of that dinky Cranberry Manor. I'd put it in a lot of different banks, Grandma said. You gotta move it around and laundry it. And then I'd put some in Grenada and Jakarta and places like that. How do you know all this? Lula wanted to know.
I pick it up at bingo. I sit with Angie Raguzzi. Her brother is in the investment business.
Her brother is mob, I said.
Yeah, Grandma said. Angie says this economy is real good for the mob on account of they're the only ones loaning money to people.
Of course, if Cubbin was planning on going somewhere and wanted to take his money with him, he could be collecting it all in $100 bills. It would take a couple suitcases to hold it all if you bundled it up nice and neat.
You know that from Angie? Lula asked.
No, I got that from Tony DiStefano. He's a bag man. He makes collections, and he's got it down to a science. He could tell you how many hundreds you could put in a brown grocery bag.
He go to bingo, too? Lula wanted to know.
No, I see him at viewings. All them old mob guys are croaking. Pretty soon there's not going to be any more mob. All the young guys are going into the hedge fund business.
What are we going to do now? Lula asked. Is it time for lunch?
Not nearly, I said. I think we sit around the corner and wait to see if Susan Cubbin drags her suitcase out to the van and goes somewhere.
That would be a good plan, Grandma said, but I got a tinkle.
I drove to Don Diner so Grandma could tinkle. Lula got double rice pudding to go, Grandma got a piece of apple pie, I got a giant wedge of coconut layer cake, and we went back to Susan Cubbin's street. No van. Her driveway was empty.
Maybe she had to run an errand, Lula said.
Yeah, maybe she ran an errand to Rio. I hear they do a lot of stomach stapling and fat suctioning there. I parked half a block away, and we ate our food. An hour went by, and no Susan Cubbin.
I drove up to her house, walked to the front door, and looked in the window. No suitcase. I took Grandma home. I dropped Lula off at the office. I called Mary DiLorenzo at the bridal salon and told her I had shoes. I was feeling sick after eating all the coconut cake, so I went home and took a nap. It was mid-afternoon when I woke up to my phone ringing.
"You're not going to believe this one," Connie said. "I just got a call from my cousin Frankie. He owns a pawn shop on Broad, and Susan Cubbin was in. She had a gold bar, and she wanted to know how much she could get for it."
"Get out. Swear to God. Frankie said he took the bar and emptied his cash register into a suitcase she had with her. He called me because he knew we were looking for her husband."
I called Morelli and asked if he was making any progress with Elwood Pitch.
"I'm running down a ton of contacts and finding nothing," Morelli said. "I looked into the clinic, and on the surface, it seems to be legitimate. Frant Sunshine is writing it off as a loss on his taxes."
"There's more going on there than a tax loss."
"I agree. From what you've told me, he has a security guard, a part-time nurse, and a perfectly maintained lab and surgical suite. He's using that building for something."
"Did you go in to take a look?"
"Nah, I have no justification for questioning them. I did a drive-by, and it looked locked up and empty."
I told him about Susan Cubbin, and I got silence on the other end. "Are you still there?" I asked.
"I'm dumbstruck. A gold bar?"
"Yeah, in trade for a suitcase full of money." I could hear Morelli laughing.
"Just when life can't get any more insane, someone comes along with a gold bar. I hope she kept her pawn ticket, because I'm sure she got hosed. Gold is trading high."
I wandered into my living room and looked out my newly fixed window. Logan was sitting cross-legged on a small patch of grass at the beginning of my parking lot. "I have to go," I said to Morelli. "I have to see a guy about a thing." I hung up on Morelli and stuffed a pair of cuffs into the waistband of my denim skirt on the remote possibility that I could catch Logan. I took the stairs down to the lobby. I stepped out the door. Logan saw me and ran away. This whole deal with Logan was dragging. At this rate, I was never going to get rid of Tiki. I really should go more proactive, I thought, but I had other stuff on my mind, like Ranger's freak. I did a quick scan of the lot to make sure no one was aiming a rocket launcher at me, and I returned to my apartment. I went into my bedroom, gathered up my laundry, and headed for my parents' house. My mom has a washer and dryer that don't require the insertion of money. Plus, I'd get dinner.
"Look who's here," Grandma said when she saw me at the door. "You came on a good night. We got a ham."
I threw my laundry into the washer and helped set the table. My dad was asleep in front of the television, and my mom and my grandmother were in the kitchen. It's not a big kitchen, but it gets the job done. Refrigerator with a freezer on the bottom. A four-burner stove with an oven. Small microwave on the counter. A sink and a dishwasher. The dishwasher is a recent addition, but my mom and my grandmother rarely use it. They still do dishes by hand while they review the evening meal and gossip about the neighbors. The kitchen is like Tiki. It's an inanimate object that seems alive. It smelled like apple pie and baked ham today. My mom had the windows open and a fan going, pulling in the scent from the geraniums in her window box. In the winter, the windows will be closed and steamy from soup bubbling on the stove. It's been like this since the day I was born, and I can't imagine it any other way. My mom has squeezed a table and four chairs into the kitchen. My sister and I did our homework here. We ate breakfast here. And this is where important announcements were made. Engagements, pregnancies, college choices. This is also where I stomped and fumed over curfews, rolled my eyes at my parents' antiquated ideas, and plotted how to sneak out when they were asleep. My sister never did any of those things. She was the perfect child. I moved out from under my parents' roof a bunch of years ago, and I haven't been completely successful at recreating this comforting and stabilizing environment for myself. I'm hopeless in the kitchen, and I never seem to have the time to build my nest. Holidays like Christmas and Easter sneak up on me and fly by before I can decorate my apartment and wrap presents. Maybe if it wasn't so easy to come back to my parents' home, I'd work harder at building my own. On the plus side, I have a hamster and a cookie jar. Okay, so I keep my gun in the cookie jar, but it's a start, right? I sat at the little table across from Grandma and watched her shell peas.
I could smell the ham heating in the oven with the brown sugar and mustard glaze, the ham studded with cloves and draped in pineapple rings, and I was ready to gnaw my arm off with hunger. Problem was, I couldn't stop thinking about Susan Cubbon and the gold bar. She shouted, "Aha!" in her husband's office, and next thing, she had a gold bar. No way could I walk away from it. "I have an errand to run," I said to my mother. "If I'm not here for dinner, don't worry about it. I'll stop by later and get leftovers." The van was in the driveway when I got to Susan's house. I went to the door, and Susan sighed when she saw me. "You know," Susan said. "I know you pawned a gold bar." Susan pressed her lips together, and she blinked away tears. "He's dead," she said. "Jerkface is dead." "Why do you think he's dead?" "It's all here. All the money he stole from those people. It's all still here. He didn't run out on me. He went to the hospital, and he expected to come back. He had it hidden. It was in a place I would never have thought to look."
"Did you tell this to the police?"
"No. It's proof he was guilty, and I feel bad about it. I mean, isn't it enough that he's probably dead?"
"What about Cranberry Manor?"
"He hated that place. He said the old people were always complaining, and he said they cheated on everything. Cards, bingo, taxes, Social Security. Half of them are collecting on dead relatives."
"It's still their money."
"I know, but I can't be the one to tell on him. It seems mean. He was my husband, and he wasn't so bad. He just had a lot of issues."
"Can I help?"
"Yes. You can help me figure out a way to get the money back to Cranberry Manor without making Jeffrey look like a monster."
"Give me some history."
"Come on in and I'll show you what I found."
I followed Susan to the dining room table and looked down at what appeared to be a blueprint for landscaping her yard.
"Yesterday I was sitting out back having a glass of wine, and the sun kept reflecting off something in the yard. So finally I got up to see what it was, and at first I thought it was a gold button that popped off something and got smashed into the grass. I tried to get it up, but it wouldn't come, and I kept digging away more grass and more grass, and what do you think I found?"
"A gold bar."
"Yes, and then it hit me. I remember Jeffrey was always talking about his big scheme to landscape the yard and how flowers were as good as gold. 5 years ago, he started working on this blueprint. He'd haul it out and work on it some, and then he'd file it away and go on to another project."
"I haven't seen your backyard. Is it filled with flowers?"
"No, that's the thing. He kept saying flowers were as good as gold, but he only planted a few flowers. There were some bushes in the yard when we first moved in, and they're still there, too, but that's it."
"He was buying gold and planting it," I said.
"Yes, and he was marking off the locations of the bars on the blueprint. It hit me like a big brainstorm, like blam. I went all over the house looking for the blueprint, and when I couldn't find it, I went to his office. It was real smart of him, because when the police searched the office, they didn't bother to take the landscape plan."
"Did you find all the bars?"
"I got all the ones that were marked on the plan. I don't know anything about the price of gold, so I don't know if all the Cranberry Manor money is there. It wasn't easy to get those stupid bars up, either. It took me all night working with a flashlight and one of those little shovels."
"Where are they?"
"In the kitchen."
I went to the kitchen and gaped at the bars. They were stacked up everywhere. "How many are there?" I asked her.
133. Actually, there were 134, but I took the one so I could get a manicure. Digging up gold bars is hell. My nails were destroyed."
"I have to think about this," I said. "Keep your doors locked and your shades down so no one sees what you've got in your kitchen."
"There are so many of them," she said, looking at the bars. "I didn't know what to do with them."
"I'll figure it out," I told her. "Just lay low until I get back to you." I left Susan, got behind the wheel, and broke out in a sweat. 133 gold bars, at least $5 million worth of gold stacked up in her kitchen. This went way beyond putting a couple $100 under your mattress. This was mind-boggling. I went back to my parents' house and ate the ham. At least I think I ate the ham. At some point, I looked down at my plate and realized it was clean and I must have eaten something, but I couldn't remember. My mind was on the bars. It was hard to get past the fact that Susan Cubbon had $5 million in gold in her kitchen, a dilemma I wasn't likely to face because the man I loved didn't have stolen gold bars buried in their backyards, at least none that I knew about. Chapter 21. I was shocked out of sleep by someone banging on my apartment door. I rolled out of bed and padded to my small foyer. The sun was pouring into my living room. The day had started without me. I looked through the peephole and didn't see anyone. There was more pounding, and I realized it was low on the door. I looked through the peephole again, this time down toward the floor. It was Briggs. I opened my door, and he rushed in.
"A person could grow old standing out there," Briggs said.
He squinted at me.
"Are you still in pajamas? It's the middle of the day."
"It's 8 o'clock in the morning."
"Well, it feels like the middle of the day. I've been up since 3. I can't sleep. This disappearing patient thing is driving me nuts, and I think the hospital is interviewing security people. They're going to fire me over this."
"I'm sure it's not that bad."
"Are you kidding me? It's worse than that bad. They didn't want to hire me in the first place."
"Because you're short?"
"No, because I'm incompetent. I have no qualifications. All I've got going for me is the short card."
"Better than nothing."
"Yeah, go figure."
I walked into the kitchen and got the coffee maker working. "What do you want from me?"
"I want you to find these guys."
"I've been trying," I said to Briggs. "Do you want coffee?"
"Yeah. You got any eggs?"
"No."
"Toast?"
"No."
"Cereal?"
"No."
"What have you got?" he asked.
"Coffee."
"How do you live like this?"
I took 2 coffee mugs from the cabinet and set them on the counter. "I keep forgetting to stop at the store." I gave Briggs his coffee, set him in front of the television, and brought Tiki in to keep him company while I took a shower. I wanted to help Briggs, but I had nowhere to go. I was out of ideas. I took as long as possible in the shower, drying my hair, applying makeup. I wasn't eager to start my day.
"Hey," Briggs yelled from the living room. "Did you die in there? Let's go."
I ambled out. "Where do you want to go?"
"The clinic. I think you should bust in there and search the place. Dollars to Donuts, Pitch is in there."
"How am I supposed to bust in? No one answers the door."
"Break a window, kick down the door. What the heck do I care? Just get in."
"Why don't you go in? You're the only one with a way to get in."
"I'm afraid I'll get caught trespassing or something, and then I'll for sure lose my job. You and Fatso break into places all the time. It don't matter with your job, and you got a cop for a boyfriend."
"I'll drive us out there and we'll take a look, but I'm not breaking in."
"How about if something's going on?"
"Like what?"
"Like a helicopter landing, or Pitch looking out a window, or attack dogs patrolling the property."
"If we see any of those things, I'll call Morelli."
"I guess that's okay," Briggs said. "I just don't want Pitch getting away."
I parked within sight of the clinic, and Briggs and I watched the building for 3 hours. "I'm hungry," I said, "and nothing's happening. I'm giving up on this."
"He's got to be in there," Briggs said. "Where else would he be?"
"Switzerland?"
"There's a car coming," Briggs said. "Duck down."
The car sped past us and turned into the driveway to the clinic's garage. We sat and waited, and an hour later the car left the clinic and drove down the road. I followed at a distance.
"This is big," Briggs said. "This is a new car. It's a silver Lexus. It wasn't in the garage that night, and it doesn't belong to Nurse Cokehead."
The Lexus left Route 1, cut across North Trenton, and pulled into the parking lot of the medical center where Craig Fish had his practice. It was Craig Fish. "This isn't earth-shaking since he's supposed to work at the clinic," I said to Briggs.
"Yeah, but why would he go there if there were no patients? He must be checking on someone."
I drove across town, hit the drive-through window of Cluck in a Bucket, ordered too much food, and stopped off at the office with a tub of assorted chicken parts and a bag of artery-clogging biscuits.
"Hey," Lula said, "it's short stuff."
"Hey," Briggs said, "it's Fatso."
I put the food on Connie's desk and got a bottle of water out of the fridge. "Anything new?" I asked.
"Vinny's in a state over Elwood Pitch."
"He's not the only one," Briggs said. "My job's on the line."
I took a piece of chicken. "Morelli's working on it." My phone rang. It was Ranger.
"Babe," Ranger said. "The bridal salon woman called me again. Why is she calling me and not you?"
"Because she doesn't have my number?"
"I'll get even," Ranger said.
I actually was loving it. "What did she want?"
"She wanted me to remind you to pick up your dress."
Lula, Connie, and Briggs were watching me when I dropped my phone back into my bag.
"Who was that?" Lula wanted to know.
"Ranger."
"That explains a smile," Lula said,
and she selected another piece of chicken. I ate a piece of chicken and a biscuit, and I was thinking it might be a good idea to stop at the bakery on the way to the bridal salon. A donut would be the perfect ending to a really deliciously crappy lunch. I loaded Briggs into the Rangeman SUV. We made a quick stop at the bakery, and I left him eating donuts in the car while I ran into the bridal salon. Mary DeLorenzo brought the dress from the back room.
"Let's just try it on to make sure everything is perfect," she said.
"No time," I told her. "Things to do. I'm sure it's fine."
"You really should try it on," Mary said. "It's such an important occasion."
"I'll try it on at home. Promise." I grabbed the massive zippered bag and rushed to the door. I couldn't resist the opportunity and turned back toward Mary DeLorenzo. "Be sure to call Ranger and tell him I picked the dress up," I told her. I tossed the heavy plastic bag into the back seat and slid behind the wheel.
"Did you ever check the morgue and the funeral homes to see if either of these guys turned up?" Briggs said. "Maybe we should take a walk along the river and make sure they're not washed up and lying there."
"I'm sure Morelli's checked the morgue, and Grandma would know if they were in a funeral home."
"What about the river?"
I glanced at him. "Do you want me to drop you off so you can check it out for yourself?"
"You'd drive away and leave me there, and I'd get mugged."
This was all true. "I'm going to take you back to your car, and my advice is to go home and take a nap. If I get any breaking news, I'll call you. Promise." A lot of skip tracing is done on the phone and computer. For the most part, Connie does the phone and internet work, and I do the legwork. I have some search programs on my computer, but Connie's programs are better. For lack of something better to do, I ran Jeffrey Cubbin and Elwood Pitch through the system on my computer to see if anything new showed up. I got a big zero, and I was surfing Pinterest when Morelli dropped in.
"I got off work and thought I'd stop by to see if I'd missed any rocket or firebomb events," he said.
"You missed a bucket of fried chicken. It was a high point in my day." Morelli sat across the table from me.
"I went deeper on France Sunshine and found some interesting things. He has similar clinics in four other states. He owns two mid-sized jets, and he's the primary on seven different holding companies."
"Success isn't a crime."
"He's operating five businesses at a loss, but he can afford to keep two jets in the air."
"What about FS Financials?"
"It's in the black, but it doesn't show the kind of profit that would offset his other expenses and losses."
"Creative bookkeeping?" Morelli shrugged.
"Hard to say, but it's one more reason to suspect the clinic."
"Do you want me to go in with guns blazing? Briggs thinks Pitch is in there. It's probably enough justification for me to enter."
"No. Let me see if I can dredge up a search warrant."
He looked at his watch and stood.
"I have to get home to let Bob out. Do you want to do something for dinner tonight?"
"I have the rehearsal dinner tonight."
"That's still on?"
"Unfortunately." Morelli looked like he was contemplating cuffing me and locking me up somewhere.
"And the wedding is tomorrow?"
"Yep. What are you doing tomorrow?" I asked him.
"Shopping for a new car,"
Morelli said. "That's almost as bad as being in a wedding." Morelli opened the front door to leave, and Brody Logan was there. Logan shrieked and ran away down the stairs.
"What the hell was that?"
Morelli said. "Brody Logan, he wants Tiki."
"Does this happen a lot?"
"Define a lot." Morelli dragged me up against him and kissed me. "Was that a lot of a kiss?" I asked.
"Not as a lot as I'd like it to be."
I watched Morelli walk down the hall, and I closed and locked my door. Moving on to the next activity, I thought. Dinner with Ranger. Ranger let himself into my apartment a little before 7 o'clock. He was wearing black slacks, a black blazer, and a black dress shirt. He was perfectly tailored and pressed, and the cut of his blazer hid the black lock at the small of his back. I was pretty much matching in a black skirt, white silky blouse, and black jacket.
"I was told you picked your dress up from the bridal salon," Ranger said.
"I thought you'd want to know." He smiled at me.
"It made my day."
Ranger doesn't smile all that often, so it's always either really wonderful or stone-cold scary. This smile was a mixture of both. I had a little black leather purse hanging from my shoulder. Ranger hooked his finger under the strap, tested the weight, and returned it to my shoulder. It was heavy enough to hold the Ruger. I told Rex and Tiki I'd be back in a little while.
I got to the door and hesitated.
"They'll be fine," Ranger said. "He's not going to hit your apartment again. He's already done that. Oren is going to kick it up a notch." He was a kind of guy who tortured bugs, pulling their legs and wings off one at a time. It was like foreplay for Oren, leading up to the kill. We were all thrill junkies, but Oren was pathological. He got his thrills from the fear and suffering of his victims. He liked the kill, but it was almost anticlimactic for him.
"Are you sure it's Oren?"
"Yes. He left a message on my phone this morning. I recognized his voice. He said it was time for him to come out of the shadows. He laughed his crazy Oren laugh, and he said I would see him soon."
"Did he say why he wasn't dead?"
"No, it wasn't part of the message."
"Do you want to tell me the rest of the message?"
"You'd rather not know."
I was sure this was true. I didn't even want to know what I already knew. I could have done without the whole ripping wings off analogy. "Did he say why he was doing this now?"
"Only that the road here wasn't easy, but he'd finally made it."
"Was he this crazy when you were serving together?"
"There were signs. Oren was a good man to have on your side and a very bad enemy. We all slept with one eye open, not just for whatever was out there, but for Oren."
"The life you have now must seem tame compared to that."
"It has its moments. I had to talk to the bridal salon lady twice today."
He had his hand at my back, guiding me down the hall to the elevator and out of the building to his Porsche 911 Turbo. I suspected the car was brand new. Hard to tell since it was identical to the last one, but its paint was unmarred, and it was lacking the aroma of horked-up cocktail wieners and meatballs. Chapter 22. The church wasn't far. It was in the Berg, and it was the Catholic church where I'd made my first communion. It was a church where my family worshipped, and I was supposed to worship. I went to Christmas Mass, and I was there for weddings and funerals, but true faith was elusive for me. Catholic guilt was a constant. I made the sign of the cross and watched Ranger. He was comfortable here. He knew the rituals. He was raised Catholic, just as I was. "Do you attend Mass?" I asked him.
"Not as often as I would like."
The answer surprised me. It had never occurred to me that Ranger might attend church. He was on the job 24/7, and he wasn't a man who easily accepted someone else's doctrine. Ranger made his own rules. Most of them were good rules, but they didn't completely line up with the Ten Commandments. He wrapped his hand around mine, and we walked down the aisle to the crowd of bridesmaids and ushers at the altar. Kinsey and Amanda were there. The parents were sitting in a pew. A priest and a wedding planner were organizing.
"We need the maid of honor to lead the bridesmaids to the back of the church," the wedding planner said.
"That's you," Ranger said to me.
"I'm the maid of honor?"
"Yes, that's why you have the special pink dress."
I gave him a sharp elbow to the rib cage and was pleased to hear him expel some air. I lined up at the back of the church with the bride and the rest of the bridesmaids. The music started, and we walked down the aisle. Step, stop, step, stop. Ranger was next to Kinsey, watching me walk toward him. His expression was serious and unwavering. Hard to imagine what he was thinking. And I hoped he had no idea what I was thinking, because I was having a hard time corralling my emotions. For a heart-stopping moment, I imagined myself walking down the aisle to marry Ranger. It was one of those bizarre what-if moments, and was so disorienting that I almost stepped on the bridesmaid in front of me. It got a smile out of Ranger and a gasp from the bride behind me. In the next instant, I saw him scan the church, nothing moving but his eyes, and then he was back to me. I left the altar on his arm after the practice ceremony. We were behind the bride and groom. Kinsey and Ranger were vigilant. Amanda looked shell-shocked. Everyone else seemed oblivious to the possibility of impending doom. "Would Oren try to do something in a church?" I asked Ranger.
"He's crazy," Ranger said. "He'd do anything."
Ranger pulled a photo out of his jacket pocket.
"This was taken a while ago, but it will give you some idea of what Oren looks like. Oren is standing next to me. He's the one with the sunglasses."
It was a picture of seven men in army fatigues. They all had rifles, and they were smiling. Ranger hadn't changed much.
Maybe he was a bit heavier now, but not a lot. Different haircut. The same serious dark eyes. Oren was shorter, stocky, blonde hair. Couldn't see his eyes behind the glasses. Dimple in his chin. I memorized Oren, but I was most interested in Ranger. I'd never seen a photo of him at a younger age, and I'd never seen a photo of the men he'd served with for at least part of his time in the military. Ranger's apartment was beautifully decorated and his furniture was comfortable, but as a home, it was sterile. There were no photos anywhere, no keepsake baseballs, no favorite coffee mug in the cupboard. Sometimes it felt like Ranger was just passing through this life, serving some purpose, not intending to stay long. "What exactly is my role here?" I asked him.
"My best guess is that Oren will target Amanda either tonight or tomorrow. Oren's ultimate goal is Kinsey and eventually me, but Oren will want to pull the wings off before the kill."
Oh, God, it was the wings again.
"Kinsey will stay close to Amanda, but there are times when you'll have to take over. He can't follow her into the ladies' room. He won't be with her tomorrow before the wedding. I have extra security in place, but they'll be at a distance. You're the one who will be at Amanda's side."
I thought Ranger's confidence in me was flattering but unfounded. I was willing to give this my best shot, but I wasn't exactly Ranger. I wasn't even half a Ranger. "Are you sure you don't want one of your men to go drag for this?" I asked him. "He'd be much more competent."
"I asked Tank, but he declined. He said pink wasn't a good color for him."
The after-rehearsal dinner was held at Cedar Mill House. It was a nice restaurant in downtown Trenton that had no relationship to anything Cedar and didn't look like a mill house. It was in a red brick building with public dining downstairs and a private dining room upstairs. The adjoining building burned down 3 years ago, and Cedar Mill House cleared the rubble away and used the space for a parking lot. Ranger pulled into the lot and cut his lights.
"I'm going to wire you for sound," he said, "and add another GPS unit."
"Another?"
"There's one in your purse."
"This is a new purse. This is the first time I've used it. How did you bug it?"
"I took a few precautions last night while you were sleeping."
"You were in my apartment last night?"
"Briefly."
"That's creepy. I don't want you looking at me when I'm sleeping."
"Babe, that's not the first time I've seen you sleep."
"But all those other times I knew you were watching me sleep."
"Not always," Ranger said.
"You waited until I was asleep so you could sneak in and plant all your secret listening gizmos, because if I was awake, I wouldn't let you do it."
"It was expedient. I had to take over a patrol for one of the men last night. I only had a few minutes to plant the GPS. When I asked you to be my date, I didn't realize it was going to turn into this. I put you in harm's way, and now I need to try to keep you safe."
Ranger removed a small plastic bag from the glove box. It contained a watch, a metal disc, and a roll of surgical tape.
"The watch looks like a sports watch, but it has a GPS system and can transmit audio. You turn the audio on and off by pushing this button. You'll see a plus or a minus sign on the watch face telling you if the audio is sending. If you get into trouble, you push the button. An alarm sounds in the control room, and we can listen in."
I took my own watch off, dropped it into my purse, and put Ranger's watch on my wrist. "Can I talk to you through the watch?"
"No, it just transmits. It doesn't receive."
The metal disc was approximately the same size as the watch face. Ranger ripped off a small piece of tape and stuck the disc to it.
"This is backup GPS. I'm going to put it inside your bra for now. If it gets uncomfortable, you can move it to the small of your back. I'd like you to wear both devices until the threat is removed."
He opened two blouse buttons and traced a line along the top of my bra with his fingertip. He bent his head, brushed a kiss across my breast, and slipped his hand inside my bra. I think I might have moaned a little, and I steadied myself by sliding my hand up the inside of his thigh. It turns out that just because I think I could have a future with Morelli doesn't mean I'm entirely immune to Ranger's hotness. He taped the disc to the underside of my breast, and his thumb skimmed across my nipple. I'd once done the deed with Ranger in his Porsche, but it involved an open driver's side door and my knee on the console. I knew this wasn't a possibility in the Cedar Mill House parking lot, especially not with a madman stalking us, someone's high beam shining in Ranger's rear window, and my resolve to not be a slut.
"Rain check this," Ranger said. "We have company."
I made some clothing adjustments, and we followed Kinsey and Amanda into the restaurant. Besides the cars carrying the bridal party, I counted 2 Rangeman SUVs in the lot and 1 more on the street. We walked through the restaurant and up a flight of stairs. The private dining room, decorated in red and gold, was dimly lit, and seating was at 3 long tables. I was placed next to Amanda, and Ranger was across from us.
"I appreciate that you would take on this job," Amanda said to me. "I knew Robert was in Special Forces, but I was unprepared for something like this to happen."
"This has nothing to do with his Special Forces background," I said. "This is about mental illness. This is about a man with a problem, and for some reason that's beyond our control, he's fixated on Kinsey and Ranger. We just have to be careful until Ranger catches him."
"Do you have a gun?"
Amanda asked. "Yes."
"Me too," she said. "I have a Beretta. What kind do you have?"
"A Ruger."
"Have you ever shot anyone?"
"Yes, but it was sort of an accident."
"You mean the gun went off when you didn't mean it to go off?"
"No, I mean he was shooting at me and I shot him back."
"That doesn't sound very accidental."
"It wasn't planned," I said. This subject was out of my comfort zone. My comfort zone ran more to bakery products, mascara, who was pregnant from my high school graduating class, and who was doing well on The Biggest Loser. I searched for a change of topic and came up short. "You must be excited about the wedding," I finally said. Amanda leaned closer and lowered her voice.
"Can I confide in you? I'm nervous. I thought this would be the most fabulous thing. All my life I've dreamed about my wedding day, the gown, the walk down the aisle, the party after."
"And now?" I asked.
"I'm not sure. I love Robert, but marriage is so permanent."
"It should be permanent. That's certainly the aspiration, but I knew firsthand it didn't always work that way. I'd been married for about 10 minutes. I was hoping for longer next time around, if there was a next time around."
"I guess most brides have pre-wedding jitters," Amanda said. "I'm not even sure I did the right thing by having such an elaborate wedding. I almost wish we'd just gone off and gotten married."
"It'll all be great," I said. "You'll be a beautiful bride." Amanda sipped at the wine that was set in front of her.
"Have you ever thought about marrying Ranger?"
"Ranger and I aren't really a couple," I said.
"Right,"
Amanda said, rolling her eyes and smiling. When Amanda rolled her eyes, it was cute. In fact, it was adorable, because Amanda was adorable. When I roll my eyes, people are afraid I've had a seizure.
"I've seen the way he looks at you," Amanda said.
"Like I'm a disaster?"
"Like he can't take his eyes off you."
"We're friends," I said, "and sometimes we work together. I don't think Ranger is ready for a relationship." Amanda glanced over at him.
"He's very handsome," she whispered.
I nodded in agreement. Ranger is drop-dead handsome. The first course was set in front of me. Green salad with croutons and chunks of tomato. Standard fare, not especially tempting. Ranger was next to the bride's mother, listening politely to her chatter. Occasionally he'd flick a glance my way, but more often than not he was looking behind me, watching a waiter, scanning the room. I was doing the same, looking for someone with a dimple in his chin. The main course was steak, vegetable medley, and mashed potatoes. I stared at the mashed potatoes and bit into my lower lip. I was hungry, but not hungry enough to risk getting poisoned again.
"I have someone in the kitchen," Ranger said from across the table. "This should be okay."
Chapter 23. It was 11 when we left the restaurant. 2 Rangeman SUVs followed Kinsey and Amanda, and another one followed Ranger. "Did you think he would make a move at the restaurant?" I asked Ranger.
"I thought he would try something at the church. It could be that he's discouraged by the security force."
"I like Amanda. It was nice to get to know her. Will she be safe for the rest of the night?"
"She's with Kinsey. I have them back in the safe house. She should be okay."
Ranger stopped for a light and looked over at me.
"Would you consider spending the night at Rangeman?"
Oh boy. Desirable for a variety of reasons, the least of which was security. But I was remembering the conversation with Amanda about marriage, and I was remembering Morelli. "Not a good idea," I said.
"You'd be safe there."
"Tempting, but I think I should go home tonight.
I'm sure I'll be fine. It's not like I'm Oren's number one target.
No, but you could be his number two target. Hal is following us. I'll leave him in your parking lot. And do not remove the GPS devices.
Yes, sir. 10 minutes later, Ranger opened my door and stepped into my apartment. He did a walkthrough, looking in closets and under the bed.
Lock up when I leave and don't open your door to anyone, he said. Are you sure you don't want me to stay?
I hesitated for a beat.
I'm sure.
He traced a line down the side of my face with his fingertip.
Would you like me to change your mind?
That got a smile from me. No, but thanks for offering. He stood outside my door and waited until he heard all my locks tumble into place. Then he knocked once and left. I glanced over at Tiki. What do you think? Did I do the right thing? Tiki looked disgusted with the whole process, so I had the last beer in the fridge and went to bed. I'm not usually a restless sleeper, but I had a horrible night. I was worried about Oren going after Amanda and Ranger and Kinsey. I thought it was remote that he would attack me. He'd made a show of sending a firebomb into my apartment, but I wasn't convinced he cared about killing me or even torturing me. I figured I was tangential to his vendetta. At daybreak, I gave up trying to sleep. I forced myself out of bed and into the shower. An hour later, I was on the road in search of breakfast. I was thinking something greasy and salty and totally unhealthy, something fattening with cheese and a worthless piece of white bread. I pulled into Cluck in a Bucket and ordered their breakfast sandwich and coffee. It was too early to go to the office. Connie wouldn't be there until 8 o'clock, and it wasn't even nearly 8. Hal was in line behind me. I waited for him to get his order, and then I pulled out into traffic. I returned to my apartment building, parked, and went back to talk to Hal. I need a nap, I told him. You don't have to stay here.
Ranger told me to keep my eye on you, and that's what I'm doing, Hal said. I get relieved at 8 o'clock.
I trudged up the stairs and down the hall. I let myself into my apartment, relocked the door, and took my coffee and breakfast sandwich into the kitchen. Rex was sound asleep in his soup can. Tiki was on guard. I ate the sandwich and sipped my coffee. This is the day, I said to Tiki. I have to get into the pink dress and march down the aisle today. I'd almost rather face Oren. I turned to go into the bedroom, and Oren was in front of me.
Your lucky day, he said.
He resembled the man in the photo, but there were significant changes. He'd lost weight, and his face and hands were badly scarred. The dimple was still there, partially obscured by the scarring. One ear was almost completely obliterated. His eyes were very pale blue, almost colorless, and his pupils were shrunk to tiny pinpoints that hinted at total insanity. I sucked in air, and the coffee sloshed out of my cup and onto the floor.
Hideous, right? He asked. Do I scare you?
I was unable to speak. My heart was pounding in my chest, and I was suffocating, unable to breathe. He was hideous, not because of the scars, but because of the eyes. The eyes were terrifying. He was wearing army fatigues. His semi-automatic was holstered, as was a large knife. His chest was crisscrossed with ammo belts. 2 grenades and packets of what I feared were explosives were strapped to the ammo belts with black electrician's tape. He was holding a black baton that at first glance looked like a flashlight, but there were 2 prongs where the light should have been. Heavy-duty stun gun, I thought. Not good news. He swung the baton and knocked the coffee out of my hand, sending it flying toward a wall. I yelped, and he came at me with the baton. He hit me hard in the thigh, pressed the prongs against my side, and I crumpled to the floor. When I came around, I had my hands bound behind me with electrician's tape, and I'd been propped up against the undersink cabinet in the kitchen. Oren was sitting on a dining room chair about 3 feet away, looking at me. He had a lighter in his hand. It was a kind you use to light a fireplace or a grill, and he was flicking it on and off.
Do you like fire? He asked.
Sometimes, I said, working to keep my voice from trembling, not wanting to show fear. I thought about the watch on my wrist. I'd been too flustered to remember to press the button when Oren initially surprised me, and now it was under layers of tape and not accessible.
It drives the devil out, Oren said.
That's why they used to burn witches. It returns everything to a pure state. It's the only way the soul can be released from the body in its most beautiful form.
Does cremation count? I asked him.
Not if it's done after death. We must all suffer to achieve grace. It's important you understand this, because you're going to suffer terribly. You're going to beg me to stop the suffering, but it will all be worth it to you. You'll die cleansed.
Why me?
You've been chosen. Ranger chose you. So now I have to cleanse both of you.
So this is about Ranger.
He did a very bad thing, and he encouraged Kinsey to follow him. They abandoned the unit. When they left, we were broken up and scattered to the winds.
They left when their tour of duty was done.
We were a brotherhood. It was a holy pact. While we were together, we had divine protection. Once a bond was broken, we were unprotected. These scars I wear are the result of that broken bond. I was attacked by the devil. It would never have happened if Ranger and Kinsey had kept us together. They did the unthinkable, and now we're all at risk. The devil stalks us, and I'm the only one who can set it right.
Ranger thought you were dead.
Everyone thinks I'm dead, Oren said. I'm like a zombie.
His voice was flat and soft. No emotion. No emotion in his face. I wondered if he'd always been like that, or if the craziness had reached critical mass and taken away all else.
When the lesson happened, I was in a truck in Afghanistan.
Lesson?
The divine intervention that showed me the penalty for Ranger's sin. The day the devil was allowed to visit me.
I could feel goosebumps break out on my arm and a chill slide the length of my spine. As a bounty hunter, I've come into contact with a good number of unhinged souls, but there was an otherworldliness to Oren that I hadn't seen before, a total detachment from reality that could only be described as cruel serenity.
We were under fire, and the truck took a hit, Oren said. The impact was so violent the truck was tossed into the air and came to land in a field. There were five of us in the truck, and everyone but me was blown to bits. Nothing left but bloody body parts. As it was, I lost my foot.
He raised his camo pants to show a prosthetic.
That's how I was identified as dead. Nothing left of me but my foot.
But you didn't die.
I'm not allowed to die until Ranger and Kinsey die. Only part of me burned in the explosion. The rest of my mortal body is waiting.
Why weren't you found with the rest of the men in the truck?
I was captured and caged. After years of imprisonment, when I realized my purpose for living, I escaped. I inched my way out of the Middle East to Europe to rehabilitate myself enough to complete my mission. And here I am.
He said this very matter of fact, his hands folded in his lap.
Imagine how saddened I was to learn that Ranger and Kinsey had infected two women with their evil, although in a way it enhances the process for them. They'll have the additional agony of knowing someone they loved had a painful and early death. Perhaps it will save them from eternal hell. So you see, I'm not actually a zombie. I'm an angel.
I was sure he believed it. He believed everything he said, the whole crazy jumble of devil and divine intervention and abandonment.
I brought this fire starter, he said. I thought I would burn you a little at a time, let you enjoy the pain, allow you to see your flesh blister and melt away. I don't want to go too fast and rob you of the experience.
I could help you, I said. Counseling, drugs, a religious advisor, a girlfriend.
I don't need help. I'm in a good place. I just need to finish my task. It's taken me years to get to this point. It's all I've worked for.
He grabbed my ponytail and set fire to it.
I shrieked and tried to jerk away, but he held fast. I smelled my hair burning, felt the fire burning my neck. And over my shrieking, I heard someone pounding on my door, ringing my doorbell.
I hate this sort of distraction, Oren said.
He yanked me up by my hair, shoved my head under the faucet, and turned the water on to put the fire out. He went to the door and looked through the security peephole.
It's a man, he said. Tell him to go away.
I went to the peephole and looked out. I'd expected to see Hal, but it was Brody Logan. Go away, I said.
I want Tiki. I've got a bad feeling. Tiki's sending out weird vibes. I want to see him to make sure he's okay.
Oren had me by the arm, squeezing hard enough to bruise. Go home, I said to Logan.
I don't have a home.
Then go to your tent.
No way. I want to see Tiki.
Help, I yelled at the door. Get help. Call the police. Get the range man guy. Oren grabbed me by my bound wrists and threw me across the room. He opened the door, yanked Logan inside, closed and relocked the door, and drew his gun.
Dude,
Logan said, eyes wide. I struggled to my feet, got a running start, and headbutted Oren, knocking him to his knees. Do something, I shrieked.